Good morning, Your Honors. Jerome Bowen on behalf of the appellant, William Pasijnik, whom I'll address as William. I would like to reserve 5 minutes, if I could, for rebuttal. I think this case, and as the court knows, when considering a summary judgment, the court, you know, views all facts and draws all inferences in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. The court also should look at the record and take it as a whole. And if taking the record as a whole could not lead a rational trier of fact to find for the non-moving party, then and only then can summary judgment be given, as there would be no genuine issue of material fact. Those are not our circumstances here. The record here, unfortunately, was not taken as a whole. The court did not view all the facts and draw all inferences in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. In fact, and I don't know why, the court made credibility determinations. It looked at five things. Number one, it looked at photographic evidence at the scene of the altercation outside of Home Depot. Two, it looked at what the paramedic said he did at the scene. Paramedic was deposed. The paramedic testified a certain way. Three, they looked at deposition testimony of the responding officer at the scene.
If I can interrupt you,
yes, Judge.
What is the evidence that you're referring to that would withstand this summary judgment?
Sure. Medical evidence. Yeah. Judge Lee, in this case, I could not see any review by the court of any medical evidence. And what is key here? Is when you take all the evidence and you view it as a whole, you see in the medical records that this gentleman suffered from severe brain damage. He had a syncope episode, which is a passing out episode due to a heart condition in 2005, fell down, had a serious brain injury. So in the medical records, in this case, specifically Dr. Muir, Dr. Baker, Dr. Chopra in Las Vegas, all three of those doctors mention in the medical records that he had an existing serious brain injury, which causes him to exaggerate, forget, led to dementia, be anxious, all of these issues that are key to what the court looked at. And so the medical evidence here supports that there are, at minimum, genuine issues of material fact that exist regarding the issue of causation of damages. Dr. Muir, a treating physician, treated him a few months after the incident in July of 2018. He said in his treatment records, which under Nevada law, he is allowed to testify about his treatment and offer causation testimony if it was a part of the treatment. It's specifically in his treatment records. Dr. Muir has in the record that he evaluated him for severe neck pain and lower back pain. Now, why would that not be reflected, those injuries, at the scene of the incident when he was assaulted and battered outside of his Home Depot? Because it's like a car accident. If we took a picture of an individual in a car accident and the individual had brain damage and they exaggerated things and said, oh, I had bleeding, I had this, when they didn't, then we wouldn't know if they had any spine injuries, which are not uncommon in car accidents, but which don't manifest themselves in photographs, in conversations. So the medical records here, Dr. Muir performed several tests. One,
before we can get to that,
yes,
for Dr. Muir, so he was not disclosed as an expert witness under Rule 26, right?
He was disclosed as a non-retained treating physician expert.
So your argument hinges it for us to consider Dr. Muir's opinion or what he said. It hinges on us finding that he was a treating physician as opposed to an expert.
Actually, Judge Lee, and you bring out something I need to remind us all, he was both. He was a non-retained treating physician, and which in Nevada, under the Nevada rules, he doesn't need an expert report. He can testify about his treatment and offer opinions if it's in his treatment and was a part of his treatment. And he was also named as a rebuttal retained expert in rebuttal of their expert. So once their expert came and rebutted his treatment, he was disclosed under Rule 26 and named as an expert in rebuttal to that expert. So he is both.
So rebutting Dr. Honig, is that who you're referring
yes,
to?
Yes, sir. And, yes, Your Honor.
And Dr. Honig's expert report was just about traumatic brain injury, right?
That's correct. But yet Dr. Honig, and thank you, Judge Lee, for pointing that out, Dr. Honig made some very important things. He went back and he reviewed the records, and he cites Dr. Muir's findings about lower back pain and lower back injury and neck pain and neck injury, and he cites MRIs that were taken. All of that is in Dr. Honig's
But Dr. Honig's was about TBI. I mean, he mentions things as a background, but for Dr. Muir to be a rebuttal, his opinion would have to be about traumatic brain injury.
There actually is another expert that they have in the case, too, that he is rebutting. And the name slips me right now, and I apologize, Judge Lee. I think it's Dr. Parker, but counsel can correct me. But he rebuts him as well because it's unclear what his opinions really were. So there are essentially two, and I think he's a emergency type position, emergency person that they hired. So Dr. Muir is rebutting him, not just Dr. Honig, but also
rebutting him. What part of the testimony, or what part of the opinion?
That said, Judge Mendoza, that said that he couldn't have been injured. He's looked at the photographs, and he couldn't have been injured. He doesn't have blood coming from him. He at the scene of the assault and battery. And yet again, we're talking about spine injuries. We're not talking about facial injuries per se. We're talking about spine injuries. And I will tell you that this jailhouse call, where his wife, who is candidly abusive to him as a person with brain injury, and tells him just do your schmuck brain injury presentation. Well, he is injury. He does have a brain injury, and he does act that way. So I don't know why she does that, but I think that we're taking that and making this, Grand Canyon leap to say that means he's making the whole thing up. Dr. Muir, again,
We can't, because then that would be sort of establishing a credibility issue, and at this stage of the proceedings, that's not what we're supposed to be doing.
Exactly, and that's one of the things that I thought was key for this court to look at. Again, on the Zetwick case, in Zetwick versus County of Yolo, Ninth Circuit case, 2017, this court, which the district court cites, says it's improper for the court to resolve genuine factual disputes or make credibility determinations, Judge Mendoza. And I think that's exactly what the court did here, unfortunately, is they took that away from the fact.
But isn't the bigger concern what Judge Lee mentioned, which is, what is he? I guess I'm concerned about the rebuttal part of this, and how do we consider Dr. Muir's testimony?
You can consider the rebuttal part to their two experts, but I don't think we need that even to overcome this burden. You have a non-retained physician who treating physician who, as part of his medical record, takes tests, facet injections, which are objective gold standard findings in medicine, facet injections, and the outcome of those, EMGs were performed, and he testified under within a reasonable degree of medical probability and certainty, which is required in Nevada, Dr. Muir, that based upon those results, it was objectively shown that he suffered spinal injuries. And so you've got medical evidence that could lead a rational trier of fact to find in favor of the plaintiff. So I don't think we need even the rebuttal, is what I'm saying to you. Is I think under the standards that we have for non-retained treating physicians, because it's in his medical records where he reviewed others' work. In fact, he, as you remember, Judge Lee, if you and Judge Mendoza, Judge D'Alba, Dr. Muir testified that he referred Mr. Pasichnik William to Dr. Chopra because of the radiculopathy. Radiculopathy is radiating pain that Dr. Chopra would look at as a neurologist. And Dr. Chopra evaluated him and said, yes, your injuries are consistent with the mechanism of injury at Home Depot, and you suffered these as a result of that July 25th incident. So you've got Dr. Chopra, you've got Dr. Muir, you've got Dr. Baker, and Dr. Baker goes through a litany of things and testifies that as his cardiologist, having that condition of that defibrillator being tackled, being put down pressure on him, being put in a headlock, and all these things would cause pain and injury and suffering to him from that defibrillator in him, that pacemaker. So we've got clearly evidence, admissible evidence that we've put in the record, medical evidence, which the court, for some reason, didn't review, Judge Mendoza, and didn't comment on. And with respect to the second issue with the CCTV, we know that CCTV, which is the video surveillance system, we know it existed. And how do we know it existed? Because the security guard, Mr. Din, that engaged in this assault and battery on behalf of Home Depot as an employee, a W-2 employee, he put in the report that CCTV existed. That went, what is relevant to this incident? He put CCTV existed. The regional
counsel, didn't Home Depot's representatives then testify that the apprehension, the part where he's actually taken down, happened outside of CCTV view?
And thank you, Judge Alba. I think the testimony was by Mr. Sablin that he didn't review the video because of the incident report that was filed by Mr. Din, which was a false incident report. Mr. Din's incident report is completely inconsistent with his deposition testimony. His incident report says, you know, I went outside and I waited for him and he came out and then Mr. Pasichnik, William, attacked me. And yet, Judge D'Alba, his conduct, what was requested in the case and what was required by the magistrate was to produce all CCTV that showed him anywhere in the store. And there was testimony from Mr. Sablin, the regional manager, Judge D'Alba, there was 13 cameras, one at each egress and ingress.
So I guess what I'm asking, though, is, so are you stating that Home Depot wasn't being truthful, I guess, when they said that for the outside footage where Mr. Pasichnik was taken down, that there was actually CCTV footage of it?
All I can tell you is what the facts show. The facts are from them, not from anything that we don't have any. We asked for it. They said they don't have it. What we know is Mr. Din, the security guard, said it existed. He cites it in the incident report as what is relevant to this incident. He put CCTV, in other words, the video surveillance, and photographs. Yet we don't have any of that. Mr. Sablin, the regional manager, said Mr. Din violated company policy by what he did, and I didn't know at the time that he did because of what he put in the incident report. He submitted a false incident report. I didn't know that. Now I know that, so, you know, it's too late to discipline him now. So I would have disciplined him then, but it's too late to discipline him now.
Did Home Depot ever receive any sort of, do not destroy evidence letter?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, this is a case that I wish it's one of those that perhaps you've had when in the past where you don't get it first. And my review of the record from prior counsel is not within the 90 days.
Okay.
It came to me much later. And so with that, I'll just kind of summarize up. We believe that the evidence support that at minimum there are genuine issues of material fact. At minimum, they were required to produce the CCTV that existed. If there wasn't something outside that showed, and I've had cases like that where they have showed it and some don't show it, the far distance, they're required to produce what he did in the store. Because here's the last issue. He was arrested. And the court says here, the court makes a comment and says, the only way on spoliation of evidence is only engage in the spoliation of documents as a matter of law only if there is, quote, some notice that the documents were potentially relevant to the litigation. Well, there's two potential litigations here. There's the criminal matter, and there's a potential civil matter. So let's just remove the civil matter. They arrested him. And I don't do criminal law, but as a criminal lawyer, I would say, where's the video? What you're alleging he did in the store. So clearly they were on notice under Nevada law, under the United States versus 40,955 in U.S.
There isn't anything in Nevada law that says that companies have to maintain records for criminal investigations, is there?
It's my understanding of the law in Nevada is that if there it doesn't really distinguish whether or not it's criminal or civil, and I'll tell you that's just my understanding, Judge Mendoza. The case is longstanding, and it says that if there is the potential for litigation, if from the circumstances you say there's going to be some legal proceeding later on, you are on notice to preserve that. Now, I wish I'd have gotten it sooner. We would have sent a preservation letter. I see my time is up.
Great. Thank you. I'll give you 1 minute.
Thank you. Thank you. So just in closing.
I think your time's up.
Okay.
So.
Thank you.
1 minute for rebuttal, I'm saying.
Okay. Thank you, Judge Lee.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Joshua Goodman, and I represent Apelli Home Depot USA, Inc. So to begin with, this court's review of this, of the summary judgment, granting the summary judgment by the district court, is a de novo review, and therefore it can be affirmed if it is supported by the record on appeal, even if the grounds were not stated in the district court's order. The issue which we've all been talking about is there evidence, admissible evidence, in the record of damages. So in the opening brief, appellant cites three potential sources for this. One is the EMT Gregory Morton.
Can you address Dr. Muir?
Sure. I was going to get to that third, but we'll swap that around. So Dr. Muir was a treating physician, but it's important, and I can cite to the record on this, that he began his treatment in March of 2019. The incident happened in July of 2018, so that's about 8 or 9 months. So the issue is not, did he have a spinal injury in March of 2019? That's not the issue in the case. The issue was whatever he had in March of 2019 caused by the incident at Home Depot in July of 2018. And Dr. Muir is very clear that causation, he testified in his deposition, that causation is not relevant to treatment, it's relevant to a deposition. So even, it's a litigation opinion. So even Dr. Muir concedes this. And the case law is very clear, Goodman versus Staples, other cases we've cited, that in order to render that kind of causation, if you're treating 8 or 9 months later, and now you're trying to, that it's not part of your treatment to ascertain, did it occur 8 months ago in an incident in Home Depot or 7 months ago in a car accident, or was it longstanding?
I believe his deposition, he says that the cervical spine was one of the areas that was injured. The patient sustained injury as to C5 to 7. He sustained radiculopathy, particularly on the left side. And third, that he related to spine in his left side lower lumbar facet injury. So I guess my question is, those are internal obviously internal injuries that you can't see from a picture or from the outside. Right. Why wasn't it appropriate for the district court judge to have considered that?
Well, whether or not the district court should have considered it,
right,
if this court now considers it, there are three problems with that.
Okay.
The first is that Dr. Muir testified that the only basis upon which he could link this to the Home Depot incident was based on what he was told by Mr. Pasnicek. And as we've already heard, you know, they're trying to get away from the bad evidence by saying he's unreliable and and prone to exaggerate. So if that's the only basis for him to say, essentially, he was asked, were you told by him that there were no pre-existing problems? Yes, that's what I was told. He didn't review any medical records to make that determination. He didn't look at the intervening history. So there's no way for him as a treating...
Well, but hold on. But did the district court consider Dr. Muir at all? Is it anywhere in the order?
It is not in the order.
So if it's not in the order, how do we know he considered it?
Well, we don't know they considered it, but this court...
If it's not in the order, can we assume that he did not consider it?
I guess my answer to that is whether or not the district court judge considered that, this court is now entitled to consider everything in the record.
I see.
And including what appellant's counsel has offered as Dr. Muir's testimony, but also the problems with that testimony, the fact that he cannot issue a causation opinion as a treating physician, that it was related to something that happened 7 or 8 months early, particularly not when it's based entirely on what his patient is telling him, and that it's not a proper rebuttal. Let's talk about the rebuttal report. So both sides cite the same law. That the purpose of rebuttal testimony is essentially to undermine the opinions of...
So you're saying that he can't take that into consideration because it's just because Dr. Muir is relying just on what the patient is telling him, but isn't he also relying on what his observations are? And
well, no observations he could make in March of 2019 mm-hmm. could possibly tell him this cervical sprain is exactly 8 months and 12 days old, therefore I know it happened on July 25th of 2018. It could have happened before that. It could have been pre-existing. It could have happened in a subsequent event. So there's no way for him just by observations to make that determination. And even if he could make that determination, it's a causation opinion which requires a Rule 26 A2B report, which was not issued. And the rebuttal report doesn't cure that because, again, Dr. Honig only talked about TBI. Dr. Walters is the other expert. Dr. Walters, if you read his report...
What about the argument of counsel makes a bit about he being not a non-retained physician?
You mean a treating physician?
A treating physician.
Yeah, so as a treating physician, you cannot, under well-established law, issue causation opinions. You are limited to the opinions inherent in your treatment. So sure, he could come in and say, in my opinion, he suffers from radiculopathy. In my opinion, he'll need back surgery. That's all part of treatment. And even Dr. Muir concedes that causation is not part of treatment. He testified to that in his deposition. And logic would tell you that. How is it that part of treating somebody in March and later of 2019, part of that is to ascertain a causation opinion to some event that occurred 7 or 8 months earlier? So that just being a non-retained expert would not allow him to issue the kind of causation opinion that he needs.
All experts do that, don't they? After the fact? I mean, how can they do it before?
They can do it contemporaneously. So if he had seen him on the day of the incident and he had fresh wounds,
unless it's contemporaneous, you're saying that no expert can come in and provide an opinion of causation.
So that's a little bit of a broad statement. I don't know that I'd endorse that. There could be other examples. It has to be part of the treatment.
Okay.
That's what the case law says.
Okay.
And so the most obvious example is contemporaneous, but there could be other examples where it wasn't contemporaneous, but this isn't one of them. And Dr. Muir, again in his deposition, conceded that.
Had Dr. Muir treated the plaintiff prior to March 2019?
No. According to his deposition, the first time he saw him was on March 19th of 2019. And I can probably get a cite for you on that in a second. Well, not in my notes. But that he did not. So the first time he saw him was at least 7 or 8 months after the incident, and that is in the record. And again, if you look at the Walters report, Walters essentially says Mr. Pasnicek is claiming all sorts of injuries, brain damage, depression, headaches, neck pain, all these injuries he's claiming, and this is his opinion. If any of these serious conditions were immediately caused by the scuffle at Home Depot, the police officer, paramedic, or jail nurse would certainly have discovered and identified such conditions, and if indicated, would have had the patient more thoroughly evaluated at a higher level care, such as an emergency department hospital. Now, a proper rebuttal opinion might be, but Dr. Walters is not considering the delayed onset of symptoms of certain of these injuries. That would be a rebuttal opinion. But you don't get to come in as a rebuttal opinion and put in the causation opinion that is part of your case in chief under the guise of rebuttal. That's not a rebuttal. You can undermine the other expert's testimony, but you cannot come in and say, and in my opinion, which is what Dr. Muir does, in my opinion, he did suffer all these injuries as a result of this scuffle. That's not rebuttal. That's just an affirmative opinion going to their case in chief. And that requires a Rule 26A2B report, which wasn't issued. So the rebuttal test, the rebuttal role that Dr. Muir functions does not allow him to make the causation opinions that are necessary for this case to survive summary judgment. So we've talked about Dr. Muir. The paramedic is cited in the brief as having said that he was dispatched due to reports of chest pain, trauma, and injury. That may be, but that's hearsay. That's not evidence that those injuries occurred. We don't know who did that. We don't know why. It's hearsay anyway. That's not his personal observation. Similarly, Dr. Baker, there's lots of quotes of Dr. Baker's deposition in the opening brief where he's talking about hypothetically, could this happen? Could this happen? Is somebody at risk of this? Is somebody at risk of that?
Counsel, the district court failed to address whether the expert's opinion testimony created a triable issue of fact, correct?
They did not address that. The district court did not address that in the order. That's correct.
Should they have?
I would have preferred if they had done that, because I think it would have made this argument a little easier. But again, I think you're entitled to look at the record and say, in fact, that had the district court considered this, the district court would properly have ruled that Dr. Muir cannot issue the kind of causation opinion that would be necessary to establish the element of damages.
We do about the fact, though, that the district court did make some credibility findings, which are not appropriate at the summary judgment stage?
So again, I think the issue before this court is there a basis to affirm summary judgment? Is there a missing element as to which there is no admissible evidence? And I would submit that there is, and that is damages. All of the evidence cited from EMT Martin or Dr. Baker, none of that do any of them say, in my opinion, he suffered this injury on that date. Neither of them say that. They're all talking about hypothetical things. This could happen, this could happen. That's not evidence that something in fact happened. Dr. Muir, we've talked about, he cannot issue a causation opinion because he didn't do a Rule 26 A2B report, and it's not a proper rebuttal opinion. So there's just no evidence. And even plaintiff, you might say, well, plaintiff can say that. Well, there's a concession here that plaintiff is unreliable, prone to exaggerate, and you can't trust anything he says. And this is where the district court's order, I'm not sure it's weighing credibility. There is case law that if somebody contradicts, this case law involved dash cam video, says I was driving reasonably and the dash cam video shows you weren't, you don't have to, that's not weighing credibility. You're entitled to say that's just wrong and I'm going to ignore it. And that's effectively what the court did.
So I understand what you mean, the blatantly contradict testimonial evidence. If you have video evidence, for example, that blatantly contradicts, then you can count on the video evidence. The issue I have, though, is you don't have that here. You can't tell just by the photographs. Yes, it shows that he exaggerated when he said, I was bloody and I was, you know, they broke my nose or whatnot. But the photographs don't tell you whether or not he had internal soft tissue injuries. The photographs don't tell you any of that sort of thing. And so for the court to rely on those photographs, as well as the jailhouse calls with the wife, is that enough? I mean, can we do that?
Well, I think in concert with the absence anywhere else of admissible expert testimony, which is required, that he suffered an injury on that date, I think you can affirm the judgment. Yes.
And that's assuming we don't count at all Dr. Muir's testimony or Dr. Muir's deposition.
Well, I think what you can – Dr. Muir can testify about his treatment, but he cannot testify that the injuries that he found 8 months later were caused by this incident. That opinion is inadmissible, and therefore you cannot consider it. That is our position. Obviously, that's for you to decide, but our position is, yes, you cannot consider it. It's not a proper rebuttal opinion. It's not a treatment opinion. Dr. Muir concedes that, and therefore – it wasn't in a Rule 26 A2B report, and therefore it's not admissible, period. It doesn't come in, and therefore there's nothing. He has not cited any expert testimony linking any injury to this incident, and I think that's fatal.
So your argument basically hinges on Dr. Muir's expert opinion. If it's not admissible, you win. If it is, there's a factual issue.
Well, if his opinion on causation is admissible, then yes, then I think there's a tribal issue. Our view is it's clearly not.
Let me ask you to pivot now to the spoliation of evidence motion that the plaintiff filed. So tell me what's going on there. Was a CCTV video, did it capture the outside?
No, and there's no evidence that it did. There's no evidence that anything having to do with this incident did. There is evidence that the exits are under surveillance. And there's no discussion anywhere in the moving papers about how that CCTV would in any way have affected the outcome of this case. It would not have shown any of the events at issue in this case what happened. I would also mention that the issue about the criminal prosecution, he was not arrested for shoplifting at Home Depot. He was arrested for outstanding warrants. So this was not a case where Home Depot had to preserve evidence because they were making a criminal complaint against him. That's not what happened. And, of course, and this was in the district court's order, there was no claim and there was no lawsuit for 9 months. And we believe under Nevada law, we don't have to preserve, you know, hundreds of hours of video because somebody a year later might make a claim. And by the time the claim was made, it was gone. But there's also, again, no evidence that it showed anything of any relevance to this case.
So what is Home Depot's policy, though,
on
video retention, CCTV retention?
So it is retained if there's a claim.
Is it only if there's a claim, or is it also retained if there's a physical altercation?
Well, if there's a physical altercation and that physical altercation is captured on the CCTV, then it should be saved. But
what's the actual policy? Does the policy have that caveat there? And if it's captured on the CCTV?
No, but the policy talks about retaining CCTV. But, you know, there's CCTV all throughout the store. It doesn't say you have to preserve every camera everywhere in the store for the whole day. There's no policy that Home Depot has to do anything like that. So they're looking for I can tell you that the wording of the policy – and the application of the policy is they're looking for the incident, whether it's an assault or an accident. If that's captured, they're going to save the video. If it's not, then they're not.
And so then what are we to do about the incident report that did not indicate that there was any sort of physical altercation?
Well, I don't think it's relevant to the motion. There may be a tribal issue of fact as to what exactly happened, you know, what kind of altercation is. But regardless of the outcome of that, our position is there's no admissible evidence of damages, and so it doesn't matter how the disputes about what happened are resolved. And I'm not sure what my timer is telling me, if I'm over or not.
You're over.
I had a couple of other issues, but if the court wants me done, I'll.
That, great. Thank you.
You want me done?
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Counsel, I know you only have 1 minute. I want to ask you to focus on your friend on the other side's question about the rebuttal evidence offered by the doctor does not, he can't make any argument regarding causation.
And we're not asking that he does in rebuttal. The law in Nevada is clear. If you are a treating physician, you're limited to your records. You're limited to the opinions in your records. He focuses on treatment. A treating physician's records are more than the treatment, which is the end. It's the evaluation. It's the assessment. It's the findings. It's the things that come back from facet injections, the review of the radiographs, and the conclusions the doctor comes to, the impressions. And he clearly under Nevada law meets the requirement to be limited to his medical records. And his medical records clearly, Judge D'Alba, state that within a reasonable degree of medical probability, these lower back and neck injuries were caused from this incident. This is commonplace for physicians. I don't understand the argument that just because of months that go by that they're disallowed from testifying to it. This is commonplace in personal injury. Months go by. Doctors come in, do treatment, review records, like Dr. Muir. He reviewed other records, came to conclusions. They're in his medical records. I think that's why you cannot...
So the proper thing to do would be to remand and let the district court judge figure that out first?
Yes. Whatever you feel is best on that, I think we remand, overturn, and go to trial. But if you think that you should remand and have further proceedings on what he considered, but he clearly didn't put in there that he considered the medical records. He clearly limits it, and I know I'm finished. He clearly limits it to this thing right here. The objective photographic evidence and evidence of plaintiff's recorded discussion regarding fabricating injury indicates there was no injury. That's the court's finding. Those are the court's direct words. He doesn't mention anything about medical treatment, medical history, anything. So thank you very much.
Great. Thank you both for the helpful argument. The case is submitted.
Thank you.
Next case.